From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Franz Kafka was, simply put, neurotic. But from his vantage point, the early 20th century, the waning days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a boring insurance company job in Prague, he put his finger on something about life that readers around the world and across time could vividly relate to. A modern world of alienation, absurdity, casual injustice, a sense of being trapped in a dull madness. We call it Kafka-esque. This hour on Point, we're looking back on Franz Kafka, the proto-outsider of the modern world, and what he saw. You can join us on air or online. What's the staying power of Kafka? Do you relate to the salesman who woke up late for work as a giant insect? Why are we still saying Kafkaesque? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Saul Friedlander, distinguished emeritus professor of history at UCLA, winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for his work, The Years of Extermination, Nazi Germany and the Jews, 1939 to 1945. A son of the same Eastern European world that Kafka knew, his new biography is Franz Kafka, Poet of Shame and Guilt. Saul Friedlander, thank you very much for being with us today. It's just wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
I wonder if you'd be kind enough. I think you have your book there. There's a letter right at the front, even before the table of contents.
Yes.
From a certain Dr. Siegfried Wolf. It's from Berlin, Charlottenburg, in April 1917, and he's writing to Franz Kafka. He describes an experience that some of our listeners may share a bit of. Could you read that for us, Saul?
Yes. So Dr. Wolf is writing to Kafka, "Dear sir, you made me unhappy. I bought your Metamorphoses as a gift for my cousin, but she is incapable of understanding the story. My cousin gave it to her mother, who doesn't understand it either. The mother gave the book to my other cousin, who also didn't find an explanation. Now, they have written to me. They expect me to explain the story to them, as I am the doctor in the family. But I am at a loss. Sir, I have spent months in the trenches, exchanging blows with the Russians, without batting an eyelid. But I could not stand losing my good name with my cousins. Only you can help me. You must do it, as you are the one who landed me in this mess. So please tell me what my cousin should think about Metamorphoses. Yours respectfully, Dr. Siegfried Wolf."
Just so Friedlander rereading
it. Very amusing.
I giggled out loud when I read that before.
Yes.
I even got any further in your book. How wonderful. Then and now, Kafka could be such a riddle. And here's Dr. Wolf saying it quite directly. Such a riddle, and yet you call him, Franz Kafka, the most protean cultural figure of the past century. Why, Saul Friedlander?
Because everybody is dragging poor Kafka to their side. I mean, high modernist, neurotic Jew, postmodern writing. You very often find Catholic writing saying, well, actually, he was Jewish, but in fact, he really speaks to Christianity, to Catholicism. Updike did that in his introduction to the Kafka stories a few years ago. So, and I won't go prophet of totalitarianism, prophet of the Holocaust, whatever you can think of, Kafka is considered as this by some group of readers.
With so many
of scholars.
Yes, and so many that he's influenced. I mean, from Camus and Sartre to Milan Kundera and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Nabokov, J.D. Salinger, and right on down. Well, let's just deal right off the bat with this Kafkaesque. You hear people say this all the time.
Yes.
You know, you get caught in some just terrible, I don't, bureaucratic or overwhelming web of absurdity and frustration and a mess, and it seems like there's no way out, and we call it Kafkaesque. Well, what does Kafkaesque mean to you, Saul?
It means, again, a lot to everybody, but I think the basic meaning of that expression is that you are caught in a, like in a labyrinth, and you don't see your way out, and that is the point. There is no way out. You see, you can, you wouldn't call a difficult situation Kafkaesque. Mm-hmm. You can use the word, I mean, one uses it for everything, but one really should use the word for a situation, the cause of which you don't understand, the dynamics of which you don't understand, and you, the way out of it you don't see. That's really Kafkaesque. It's a labyrinth. It's when one has used it a lot for bureaucracy. In a way, it's true. Mm. You don't see when you punch the numbers where the human being is at the end.
Yes.
But, I mean, that's a very easy way of doing it. But in Kafka's case, I mean, a novel like The Trial, you don't know why the man is accused. You don't know who accuses him. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the arguments are, and at the end, he's executed.
Yes.
And never knows what happened to him.
The stakes are much higher in The Trial, but I have to say, for me and maybe millions of others, every time I have to pick up the telephone and call, let's say, tech support, and I get a series of answering machine prompts and answers, and so I am in the labyrinth, and I'm thinking of Franz Kafka as I try and figure out my new, whatever, iPhone. I'm lost in Kafka land.
Yes.
Take us back to the setting of his life. It's one that you, your family, knew very well.
In a way, yes. Strangely enough. Well, not so strangely. We mm-hmm. are from Prague.
Mm-hmm.
Let me first say how I discovered, in a way, the link. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, my parents' generation, you will see it's practically identical.
Mm.
I read the first biography about Kafka when I was 15 in France, in the French translation of Max Brod's first biography mm-hmm. of his friend Franz Kafka. And then, of course, it brought me into Kafka's writings and so on and so forth. And when I came to Israel a few months later, I discovered the same biography in German at my uncle's. And he told me that Max Brod, the biographer, had stayed with him for a few months, taken chairs when he left, and never returned them. That was my introduction.
Max Brod, not Kafka. So, okay.
No,
his
now
friend
Kafka.
And literary executor.
Now Kafka.
Yeah. Yeah.
First of all, Prague is our background, my family's background, mm-hmm. of course, and for me for a few years. And then we lived a part of the time in Rochlitz. We were Czech Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in Rochlitz, the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia at the time.
So assimilated German-speaking Jews.
You know, the Sudetenland, mm-hmm. the area which Hitler took over then in 1938 after the Munich Agreement. So mm-hmm. there was a German-speaking area where you spoke Czech as well, but most people there spoke German. And Kafka writes in his diaries that he very often visited towns which, I mean, even the town where we lived, Rochlitz, he writes Rochlitz. He makes a slight mistake, but he mentions Gablonz and other towns where he went for his work, delegated by his insurance company in Prague.
Yes.
So that's one little thing. Secondly, Czech Jews at that time, at Kafka's time, spoke German much better than Czech.
Mm-hmm.
And Kafka knew, wrote in German, was, of course, a perfect Germanist, if you wish, yes. And he knew Czech, but again, like Jews of his generation, not as well as German. And when he wrote a letter in Czech, he asked somebody to correct it. But then he studied law after the high school, where most of the pupils, by the way, were Jewish. He went to law school at the Charles University, to the German again law school. Mm-hmm. We speak now of the beginning of the 20th century. 15 years or so later, my father went to the went through the same high school.
So the cultural connections are deep.
Went to the same law school.
Yeah.
And they both then became what you call then in German Prokurist, that is, people who ultimately were allowed to sign contracts and so on, in an insurance, a German insurance company in Kafka's time, Austro-Hungarian one.
Sophie Linder, I hate to interrupt, but we have a short break right here. It's so great to have you with us. The great historian Sophie Linder, now biographer of Franz Kafka, who's all over the place. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Franz Kafka, writer, loser, genius, puzzle, the man who brought us Kafkaesque, the man with the mind-bending stories you can never quite figure out. Wonderful historian Saul Friedlander joins us from Los Angeles. He's written a new book, Franz Kafka, Poet of Shame and Guilt, the latest in Yale's acclaimed Jewish Lives series. Brings to life a man who described a circumstance of modern life that most of us at one time or another feel we can identify with all too well, that Kafkaesque moment of alienation, frustration, feeling trapped in some hideous way. We love to make the reference, have fun with it, even as we shake our head. Here's Woody Allen's 1977 film Annie Hall. Allen's character gets a backhanded compliment from his current girlfriend, Pam, played by Shelley Duvall.
Sex with you is really a Kafkaesque experience.
Oh, thank you.
I mean that as a compliment.
Okay, sex with you is a Kafkaesque experience. Here's a spoof news video from The Onion reporting that the fictional Franz Kafka International Airport in Prague has been named the world's most alienating airport.
The report found the average delay at Franz Kafka International is 31 hours longer than the next worst airport. We spoke to several American travelers who reported spending weeks and in some cases months waiting for flights.
I asked the ticket person what gate my flight was at, and they said that the airline I was flying didn't exist, and everyone keeps calling me S.
Franz Kafka International, the world's most alienating airport. And here's a little bit from the 2000 film The Squid and the Whale, poking fun at the overuse of the term Kafkaesque in this scene where two high school students, played by Haley Pfeiffer and Jesse Eisenberg, discuss The Metamorphosis.
Oh, I read The Metamorphosis. You were right, it's great.
Oh?
Yeah, I mean, so bizarre. What do you think is happening at the end with the sister?
Oh, yeah, I think she's, it's ambiguous, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's gross when he turns into the bug, but I love how matter-of-fact everything is.
Yeah, it's very Kafkaesque.
Because it's written by Franz Kafka.
Right. I mean, clearly.
Yeah, it would have to be.
From The Squid and the Whale, just a wonderful back and forth. Saul Friedlander, having now written this, you must hear references to Kafka all the time. You must hear how commonly people, even now, raise this writer.
Yes, absolutely. It has become so common that you don't even pay attention to it anymore. Kafka is all over. Too much, I think. But that's part of, in a way, using and misusing some great works of literature, music, or whatever.
Maybe in part we write on his blackboard because of what Eric Heller called the most obscure lucidity in the history of literature. So lucid and so incomprehensible or obscure at the same time. How did Kafka accomplish that? Or maybe more importantly, why?
I don't think that this was, in a way, intentional. That was the word. He spoke of his own talent to express a kind of dreamlike world. He's in a non-theoretical at all. I mean, one has to remember Kafka was a poet in a way. Mm-hmm. He was a master of metaphor. He followed dreams. He expressed them better than most modern writers. But you never you followed him into this dream world, which you may also call a nightmare world. You couldn't figure out, as in many dreams, what really was meant. You could explain it, interpret it in the most various ways. I would say that Kafka's genius was in expressing this other reality, if you wish, which looks like our world to the last detail, but is not. When you entered Kafka's world, you think that you are in everyday life. And that is his greatness, in a way, to transform the extraordinary into the ordinary. That is, you think you are really walking behind him in the streets of Prague,
yeah,
and everything looks normal, but it is not.
Saul Friedlander writes in his new biography, he talks about Kafka's fiction, and appearances of the real world there are kept, he writes, but like in a dream, its substance of the real world is inexorably dissolved until the cardboard reality ultimately collapses. Kafka's method of derealization, you call that. But you say, Saul, that his fiction was, quoting you here, was but a more or less heavily disguised autobiography. He lived at home until he was 31 years old, and these absurd, surreal experiences he's describing, in what sense autobiography?
Well, that's true. The dream world is there. And it's a world of symbols. It's a forest, let's say, mm-hmm, into which you enter and then you don't find your way out. But if you look then at the details of it, you recognize events that replicate in a more or less distant way Kafka's own experiences as we know them from his very detailed and very open, explicit, mm-hmm, diaries, and from the very voluminous correspondence he had with friends, with Broad, of course, mm, with his women friends, Felice Bauer, Milena Jesenska, and so on, and with many other people. So, in a way, you have the fiction on one side, mm-hmm, and then you have his real life, if one may put it that way, on the other. And if you go very carefully about it, mm-hmm, and look at real life, mm, in quotes, of course, you recognize the symbols in the dream world, at least some of them, and you see the connections.
I want to look at the candor of those diaries and the shame and guilt that, right in your title, you have at the, yeah, heart of Kafka's work. Saul Friedlander, the great historian, now biography of Franz Kafka, is with us from Los Angeles. Saul, lots of callers here. Let me begin to bring them in, if I may. Orlando, Florida. Steve is calling. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
I'm remembering being back in college when I took a film course, and the professor showed the film version of Kafka's The Castle.
Yes.
Which was 2 hours of Jeremy Irons trying to get across the river to the castle. And after 2.5 hours, they simply stopped the film and throw up a slide that says Kafka died before he finished the story.
Yes.
And the scream from this room full of students, like, no, that can't be how it ends. And the professor just said, that's Kafka.
So is that Kafka-esque to you, Steve, or just Kafka?
It must be. Had to be.
Yeah. Remind us of The Castle. So thank you, Steve. That story and that ending in the film, why, Saul Friedlander?
I don't know the film, mm, I must admit. I think I saw years ago Orson Welles' The Trial, but I don't remember a film about the castle. That is, I didn't see it, or I don't know about it. But the story itself is, I mean, it's a recurrent theme in Kafka's novel. A hero, I mean, a character, be it like in the trial, a bank official, in America, it's the first novel, actually. America, it's called America in the States, but usually you call it The Man Who Disappeared. Mm-hmm. It's a young man who goes through a kind of fictional America. And in The Castle, the last novel, it's somebody who comes as a land surveyor.
Yes.
He thinks has been called to survey some land near a castle, but nobody called him, actually. And he's there trying to get to the castle, to get to the people who supposedly called him. Now, the person who called from Orlando is correct. I mean, there is no end to the story, to the castle, but there is, in fact, the three novels were not finished. America wasn't finished. Mm-hmm. The trial wasn't, although it looks like complete, more or less, but that's Max Brod's rearrangements. And the castle, of course, is completely unfinished, and it stops in the middle, in a sense. So that's one of the aspects of Kafka's works, that he entered into that labyrinth himself and then never completed many of the stories and certainly the great novels. But as you well know, and as the caller knows, we are quite in that world without, and not knowing the end, in a sense, is part of the message.
Help us begin to disentangle some of the elements of that autobiography that may have led him to this perspective on the world. There are aspects of culture and religion, ethnicity, sexuality. You write, and there's so many angles to this, but you say in contextual terms, Kafka appeared as a neurotic Jew, a religious one, a mystic, a self-hating Jew, a crypto-Christian, a Gnostic. maybe that's one place to begin to help us understand this man.
With Gnosticism?
Well, no, maybe with let's start with his Jewish background, and then you can take us to what makes him or might have made him be seen as a crypto-Christian.
Yes. The Jewish, it's, by the way, everything in Kafka is in a way ambivalent. You cannot put your finger exactly on a clear definition of identity, let's say the Jewish identity. Kafka was a Jew, recognized it. He never denied his being Jewish. He actually accentuated this. He writes at some place, my Hebrew name is Amshel, and so on. So he is Jewish, and he knows that. But then he knows also, or he thinks, of all the negative aspects of this identity. He is, some have even considered him as being slightly anti-Semitic, if you wish. He really speaks very openly, in his opinion, of course, about what he sees as Jewish defects in social life. He speaks a lot about the generation of his father, and he dislikes those
Jews. How do you interpret this? Is this his honest assessment? Is he being influenced by anti-Semitism in Prague of that time?
I think he did internalize some of the anti-Semitic discourse of his time. I mean, there was a famous book, Sex and Character, written by a Jew, by the way, a very young man, Otto Weininger, who wrote that book, anti-women and anti-Jewish. And Weininger converted to Protestantism, wrote the book at the age of 23, and then committed suicide. And Kafka knew the book, as everybody at that time. It was a bestseller in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it's read to this day. And Kafka seems to have been influenced by some of the ideas, like, for example, the effeminate aspect of the Jewish body, the weakness, in a way, of the Jewish personalities. At that time, the gay aspect would not have been stressed so much, but that's what Weininger meant. He had a horror of women, Weininger. And Jews for him, Jews and women were the same thing. Jews were effeminate, were womanly. And Kafka, if you read him carefully, you see that here and there, these ideas are not absent. So that you have this influence of the environment.
Mm-hmm. This sort of anti-Semitic culture of that
time. Yes, a kind of context. But he always applies it to himself as well. He sometimes even goes very far in explosions of, let's say, anger at the Jews. He writes to Milena Jesenska, his last, the last was Dora Diamant, but his great passion, I think. He writes to her, you know, you have too good an opinion. Milena was not Jewish, otherwise all his connections were really Jewish. Mm-hmm. You have a much too great opinion of the Jews. I would like to see them all put in a drawer, and then I would open the drawers slightly to see if they have already... if they're already dead, if they're not, I close the drawer. And that's the one case where he really goes overboard. Otherwise, and he always says, and me included, I would like to see all of them in a drawer, me included. Now, it's interesting that this few lines to Milena were not included in the correspondence after the war. It was too close,
too
in a way, to reality.
To the Holocaust.
But, of course. And otherwise, he has this criticism of the role of Jews in German culture, of the role of Jews in German politics. I mean, he is a critic. On the other hand, he follows Zionism very closely. Not that he is a Zionist. Mm-hmm. He is not. He is very interested in Jewish history, reads a lot about it. The moment he discovers the Yiddish theater from Galicia, from Lemberg, who comes to Prague, he discovers Eastern Jewry. You said before that he was part of Eastern Jewry. No. Kafka was part of Central European Jewry. That is Germany, Prague, and Vienna, Budapest, if you wish.
Yeah.
Eastern Jewry came to him in 1911 with that theater, and he became enthusiastic about that theater. He expressed his love for the atmosphere of this Jewish atmosphere of Eastern Europe, which he considered as authentic.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Franz Kafka, writer, kind of loser, genius, puzzle, the man who brought us Kafkaesque, the man with the mind-bending stories you could never quite figure out. Saul Friedlander, the great historian, is out with a new biography of Franz Kafka. Franz Kafka, poet of shame and guilt. He joins us today from Los Angeles. Lots of response, Saul Friedlander, online. Amy writes, I only discovered Kafka in college. I truly feel his writing is able to easily transcend generations, has captured the modern world with his symbolic and jarring style of writing, no question. Another listener says, Kafka's the author who best captures our postmodern age. He not only influenced other artists, he informs and influences the age we live in, the 20th century's most important author of fiction. Let me get a couple of calls, if I may, Saul Friedlander. Josh in Montreal, in Canada. Thanks for calling, Josh. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick comment and then ask the author a question. You mentioned Gitmo, and that sort of recalls one of Kafka's story, the penal colony. And it helps us understand, I guess, the postmodern, maybe post-democratic world we live in, where power is somewhat unchecked, and the individual is sort of feels crushed by a huge bureaucracy. And I think Kafka captured that in 1913, 100 years ago, so brilliantly. And his works gave me courage to face our modern, postmodern situation. I just want to ask, though, the author about Kafka's relationship to his father. I understand that he had a conflictual relationship with his father.
Famously.
And he felt him to be a bit oppressive. And I wondered if that kind of was a life force for him to create this sort of dark, ironic portraits of the world he lived in, and that reflect our world today.
Yes, Josh, we'll go right to that, and you've raised more that's wonderful as well there. But Saul Friedlander, what about it? He, of course, wrote famously at length to and about his father. What about Kafka's relationship with Dad?
The caller put he saw exactly the issue. Kafka's relation to his father was not good. And there is a famous document, the letter to the father, or the letter to his father, where he, over 100 pages, the letter was written 1920. He brings up all his, all what he has to all his complaints about his father. Mm-hmm. But you see, even the letter, and all what we know is ambivalent, as usual in Kafka. That is, he says all that, and he calls the letter a lawyer's brief. On the other hand, there are moments of real, I would say, tenderness within the letter. He also recalls good moments. And I think that Kafka's relation to his father, the father outlived him by many years, outlived Franz. Mm-hmm. The negative aspect is what is usually stressed, but it is more complicated than that. Kafka also had love for his father, mixed with this constant criticism. And some authors think, and I agree, that Kafka made almost, staged this whole negative relation, and knew his father's weaknesses. The father was a blustering guy who would yell at everybody, but actually a good person and a rather weak person. And Kafka would, you know, maliciously, not in the bad sense, but with some, let's say, humor, be the puppeteer in this family drama.
If it was so difficult, I mean, he lived at home until he was 31.
Exactly.
He was engaged to be married three times, but never did. Why didn't he just leave, go?
Exactly. You see, that is the answer to the question. If it had been unbearable, if it were unbearable, why didn't Kafka go away? He stayed with his family in his family home. Of course, he had to go to various places for his health, but came always back until less than a year before his death, so that he couldn't have hated his father to such a point that he would have not been able to stand the situation. He did. And I think he, and others have said that he enjoyed to a point the drama of it, and the continuous recriminations, and so on and so forth. He didn't like families. He didn't like, his relation to his mother wasn't excellent either. So it was, but he also, he stayed there. He stayed there until almost the end of his life. And so there must have been some let's call it crassly an psychological adventure.
You put sexuality, I guess, frustrated sexuality at the center here. I mean, you say you point to shame and guilt as key motivators for Kafka. Describe the roots of those, if you would, Saul Friedlander.
Well, that is the point. I mean, everybody who reads Kafka senses immediately that there is a theme that goes through the work of a sense of guilt, a sense of being guilty of something. Look at the trial. I mean, the man is being executed for something he's guilty of. He doesn't know what it is. And the shame, the famous last line of the trial, like a dog, he says, when he's being executed. Mm. And it is as if the shame was to survive him. So that the last word, in a way, is shame. You have guilt and shame all the time. And I think, and you see, Max Brod, the biographer, censored heavily Kafka's writings.
Censored, yes.
What you have in English, what you have in the German editions of Kafka's work, edited by Max Brod, is heavily censored. But now we have a German edition, a critical German edition based on the manuscripts. It's not yet translated into English. Mm-hmm. And when you compare the two, you see that what Brod systematically censored was Kafka's sexuality. That is, Kafka's tendencies, his rather very negative expressions about women, his fear of sexuality with women, his fear of sex, actually, his disgust of sex with women, his tendencies to homoeroticism. Kafka was not actively gay. That is, there is no proof of that. But he certainly expressed in his works and in his life attraction to male figures. And that is maybe what made him write to Milena, "I am dirty, Milena, I am terribly dirty." And he doesn't explain. He was attracted here and there, you see it in his diaries, to also to adolescents or to children.
Yeah.
But never, of course, these were fantasies. He never implemented anything, but he fantasized. And that, in my opinion, is part, at least, of the feelings of shame and guilt.
But I found myself wondering as I read you on just this point, Saul, and you go in great, wonderful depth there. But so that one can imagine that this kind of ambient guilt in Kafka's work having roots in exactly that. But there's also a sense, or maybe we've just interpreted this, in that ambient guilt, that floating sense of guilt of a kind of complicitness in the very oppressiveness of modernity that his books seem to rail against, that somehow we're complicit, not necessarily out of anything to do with a repressed sexuality, but something larger, some kind of philosophical complicitness on our part in our own oppression or the oppressiveness of modernity.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, every concrete element, let's say the sexual guilt, can then be transformed symbolically and raised to other levels. And I'm sure that there is a kind of metaphysical sense of guilt. About modernity, it's in a way I didn't think very much of that. He is, of course, oppressed by modernity. He is the poet of the terror of bureaucracy. But being a helpless being, in a sense, in our modern world where you don't know whether to turn right or left. Mm. But I don't remember now offhand that he expresses complicity in that. He's just the victim, you see. The victim is not always complicit in the system to which he, the victim belongs.
Maybe I've brought that myself. We all
it's one more idea.
Ed, in Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on with Saul Friedlander. Thanks for calling, Ed.
Thanks, Tom. Hi. I grew up in Iran in the 60s and 70s as a high school and college student, and many of my friends, both in high school and college, were deeply into reading Kafka and Albert Camus and Sartre. Yeah. And actually, and also a famous Iranian writer called Hedayat, which was in turn influenced by Kafka very much. Hedayat himself committed suicide in France. And then I also had a couple of friends, one in high school and one in university, who committed suicide because they were so much into Kafka and expressing their works in sort of a Kafka's way. I just wanted some comment from our honored guest on that.
Yes.
That kind of kept me away, actually made me afraid, or kept me away from delving more into Kafka.
Yeah. Yes, Ed, thank you. Saul Friedlander, have you followed the threads as far as Iran?
No, I did follow, and I am very touched by what your correspondent just said. Do you think, I mean, I'm almost addressing the person who called you, that it's the reading of Kafka that would have impressed these intellectuals so much that he didn't commit suicide, but he died practically at age 41 of tuberculosis. But his world, of course, is so oppressive that you can think of people committing suicide by getting too deep into it. But that is something difficult to prove, except if those people have diaries saying, I mean, my reading of Kafka brings me to such despair I'm taking my life. But I wasn't aware of that, I must admit.
I mean, you write about Kafka achieving a state of almost ecstasy in writing. You quote him saying the strange, mysterious, perhaps dangerous, perhaps saving comfort there is in writing. He talks about a higher kind of observation is created. The higher it is, the more independent it becomes, the more incalculable, the more joyful. But to our caller, Ed, in this response of despair, permit me just to read some from you near the conclusion of this wonderful book, Saul Friedlander. You write, in Kafka's fiction, all main characters, humans or animals, try to reach some unattainable goal, and all such hopes are dashed, as in Genesis, where an angel with flaming sword stands guard at the gate of paradise. Thus, in Kafka's fiction, the possibility of entering or returning to some land imagined as free and promised is blocked by insuperable obstacles. But whereas in Genesis it is the God of the Bible who forbids the return to paradise after the fall, in Kafka's texts we, like the protagonists, never find out what power crushes such fundamental human hope, the symbolic sum total of all human hopes. If that's not a despairing point to be brought to, Saul, I don't know what is.
Well, I agree. I agree that reading Kafka is reading despair. There is no doubt about that. But then you quoted his elation about writing. It's true that he had also moments and expressions of despair about writing and saying that writing was serving the devil and so on. But all in all, writing is his salvation. You know, he writes to the very last moment of his life. He's correcting the proofs of his last story, Josephine and the Mouse Folk, on his deathbed, really. And the last story is actually The Hunger Artist and so on, but Josephine. So that writing is his life, and he doesn't give up writing ever, even at the very last moment. His real desperation is about the obstacles that he faces in writing as he would love to write. But it is true that the general impression one gets from reading through Kafka, apart from the moments of elation, is one of despair. I think of a moment when he writes, everything is untrue. Life is like a cell without windows, without door. I mean, he's there, he's suffocating. And suffocation is the main fear at the end of his life. Of course, he has tuberculosis, which then reaches the larynx, and he has great difficulties in breathing, cannot feed himself, and so on. So suffocation, and there is this world that encloses him that is suffocating. So it may be that all that can lead somebody to such some reader to such despair that it would lead to suicide.
Franz Kafka, what Saul Friedlander, you call the iconic voice of high modernism. It's an amazing story. We've read, you reveal so much more. The great historian of the Holocaust, Saul Friedlander's new biography is Franz Kafka, Poet of Shame and Guilt. Saul Friedlander, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank
Wonderful
you very much.
Speaking.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.